In 2004, an editor asked New York Times reporter Frank Bruni if he had any interest in shifting gears from hard news to becoming the paper's restaurant critic. His response must have been perplexing, if not off-putting. He says, without meaning to, I laughed. She didn't appreciate the robust absurdity of what she was asking. He's written that in his new memoir, Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater. And it's because for his entire life, Frank Bruni has had something of a turbulent relationship with food. His book is published by Penguin Press. I'm very happy that it brings Frank Bruni back to our show. Hello.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So how did the editor respond when you laughed at her question?
Well, she didn't understand why I was laughing because she didn't know about my whole history. I think we kind of glided right over that at that time. But later on, an editor who knew me better, one of the last questions she asked me before I took this job was whether I could do it in terms of having to consume this much food.
See, I would have thought the editor thought you were hesitant to leave the news department.
I had a great job at the time. When I was having that phone conversation, I was sitting in my office in Rome where I was privileged enough to be the Times Rome correspondent. So I did have a dream job, and that would have been a good reason to chuckle.
And you were being offered the job as William Grimes was leaving. Before he became the restaurant reviewer, he'd written about hard liquor, if I remember correctly. And then after he reviewed books for a while, and now he's taken over the obituary page. Are there any lessons to be learned from all of this about how the New York Times operates? you were their political reporter in Italy.
We like to shake things up. Well, you know, when I was hired at the Times too many years ago, they said we don't hire people for jobs, we hire them for careers. And I guess Biff Grimes and I are proof of that.
Well, I think that in the case of a restaurant reviewer, they probably liked the way you wrote. They liked your writing style.
That's right, yeah.
And that probably was more of a concern than as long as you kind of could knew the difference between a white wine and a red wine.
Barely, yeah. No, you're right. They wanted first and foremost to put someone in the job whom they thought it would be fun to read week after week. And then that decision having been made, they wanted to make sure it was someone who was a food enthusiast with some good background and breadth of experience.
Well, you're right that you viewed the offer as the kind of ultimate dare or dead reckoning that a good narrative called for. So you... What was the good narrative here?
Well, the dead reckoning in the terms of I had spent so much of my life trying to figure out and failing to figure out a healthy relationship with eating. I'd been an overeater. I'd been a bulimic. My weight had gone up and down. So it just seemed to me like a perfect irony that this person would end up eating professionally for a living.
Do you think you might not have been offered the job had that editor seen you and how heavy you were at the time?
That's a good question. Some of the editors who were ultimately involved in the decision had seen me, so I think I would have been offered the job, but I think that explains why there was a conversation beforehand about, hey, are you of all people sure you want to lash yourself to this many calories?
My guest is Frank Bruni, whose memoir, Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater, is published by the Penguin Press. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You grew up in White Plains in a family that, as you write, never skimped on food. Cooking was at the center of it all. And when this book was excerpted in a July edition of the New York Times Magazine, it ran under the title, I Was a Baby Bulimic. Now, you weren't a bulimic when you were a baby.
That's a term of art more than science. When I was little, I would get so upset if I wasn't given third and fourth and fifth helpings that my tantrums would become so florid that I would sometimes throw up. So I was using that phrase to introduce that degree of gluttony that was in me from the start.
But your mother usually came through.
You know, I think it's hard to deny a kid who wants food, what he wants. I think we're all born different, and I was born with a really big appetite.
And you write, I remember almost everything about my childhood in terms of food, in terms of favorite foods, to be more accurate, or even favorite parts of favorite foods.
Well, like the fatty edges of a lamb chop. Yeah, I mean, I was just a food fetishist from the get-go. It's hardwired into me, and as much as I came to fear food over time, I never stopped loving it.
You like the homemade chocolate sauce that they put over the Breyers ice cream. Obviously,
Yes. The
Breyers ice cream was wanting, or did you know it was wanting at the time?
At that time, I was 7 or 8, so Breyers was just fine. These days, I might have a more discerning approach to ice cream, yeah.
Now, who did the cooking in your home? Was it your mother or your
grandmother?
It was
It was my mother. But in my extended Italian-American family, one of the kind of rules of the road was that after a woman married one of the Bruni men, this is going to sound very sexist, but this is the way it was at the time, the woman would then go to grandma's kitchen and, you know, at grandma's elbow would learn how to do all the Italian recipes.
And you write that for your grandmother, food was her currency and communicator like no other, trumpeting pride, establishing wealth, proving love. It gave her what bearing she had in the world. What was she cooking? Was she cooking old world food?
She was cooking the recipes that she'd learned as a little girl in Puglia, which is a region of southern Italy. I don't think my grandmother ever learned a new recipe in her life. You know, she came to America with a certain arsenal, and she used it well. And she didn't want to. She didn't want to learn what she didn't know. She wanted to just ace what she knew.
Now we should point out that you look great.
Thank you.
That nobody would say this is a guy with a weight problem. But you had one for most of your life. What age did you begin thinking of yourself as bigger than everyone else or fatter than everyone else?
I mean, quite early on, probably 4 or 5, because I mean, when I go back and I look at snapshots of the family then, it's clear like I'm bigger and rounder than my older brother. You know, I was being taken to shop in different sections of the store. By the time I was 7, kids were teasing that my initials FB must stand for Fat Boy as opposed to Frank Bruni. So
now, why weren't your brothers involved with food as you? They grew up in the same dining room.
I think it's proof that we all have a different genetic inheritance. I mean, I think I was born with a big appetite. I also tended to be the physically lazy one, so I wasn't outside running around as much. It's just a matter of nature.
And an offshoot of all of this is, you write, your mother was a sucker for fad diets.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting. We talk a lot right now in the society about childhood obesity and kids with weight problems and how to help them out. And one thing that's always said is kids model their parents' behavior. Well, I watched my mother do the popcorn diet and the grapefruit diet and the Scarsdale diet, and I think I took a cue from that.
You tried all the diets yourself?
Over the course of my life, I probably tried every diet there was. And I would do these extreme, I would do like a 3-day fast, I would do a juice cleanse, all of it. Yeah.
But often food, and your story is very much about food being a kind of self-medicating. So when you get depressed because you're overweight, you wind up eating instead of not eating.
Well, I had it worse than that, because if I was depressed, I ate. If I was stressed out and jittery, I ate. For me, food was always the answer. It was it was the one pure rush of pleasure I could count on. And it felt almost like a drug to me that way.
And then when you told your grandmother you didn't want to eat something that she'd prepared because you were on a diet, she got upset.
Hell hath no fury like Grandma Bruni denied the ability to feed you.
So what was this? How did this affect you as you were growing up? Did you engage in sports?
I did. One of the things that saved me for a period of time from being overweight was, you know, against all expectations, I turned out to be quite an athlete when it came to swimming. All of my clumsiness on land disappeared when I got into the water. So for many years when I was a teenager, I was swimming about 4 hours a day, and it enabled me not to do the hard work of restraining my appetite because I was burning up so much.
And were you losing weight as a result?
I was a only moderately or slightly heavy kid for as long as I was swimming.
And then you also tried other things like fasting and taking amphetamines.
Well, what happened is after I quit swimming, which I wanted to do, I was kind of tired of it, I knew that I had to come up with something else. And that was right. It was right then that I, for a little while, was bulimic. And then after that, there were amphetamines. I was always looking for a magic bullet, you know.
Now, most people will catch on to the fact that somebody's bulimic because in the middle of the meal, they get up more than once. Were people suspicious?
Well, that's why I ultimately stopped. Some friends of mine in college who ate with me probably more frequently than they would have liked to, given the circumstances, finally said to me one day when I was coming back from the bathroom, you know, we know what you're doing when you rush off after a meal.
Well, you write that bulimia is a logistical and tactical challenge as much as anything else. It demands planning.
It does, yeah. I knew on campus where all the bathrooms were. What I knew was where all the private bathrooms were. So I knew that I could go there, or over there and find a bathroom that would shut and I could be alone.
Well, you couldn't blame your mother and grandmother's cooking for this problem now.
I don't blame anyone. I mean, I think I just...
Well, I mean, you were in college.
Yeah.
This was an opportunity to change your ways.
Right. But I was, you know, I'm an example of someone who was always trying to find an easy way out, and that's why decades went by before I had the kind of healthy relationship with food where I could be a restaurant critic.
What was your waist size when you were in college?
In college, it was pretty normal. I think it was probably 33, 34, but it was being kept that way through these unhealthy means.
What about just working out in the gym?
Well, that's what I do now. No, I mean, you're right. I mean, the answer in the end is an unglamorous one. It's portion control, it's exercise, it's energy in, energy out, but I wanted to cheat the system.
So it was bulimia and laxatives and things like that.
Bulimia, laxatives, amphetamines, as you mentioned. I mean, all for brief periods of time, but one after the other after the other.
Did you ever seek help?
I never did, because I always had the belief, you know, I guess correct in the end, but maybe it wouldn't have taken me so long, that I could kind of find the strength within myself to fix it all.
Well, exacerbating this whole thing was that you realized you were gay. I don't know when when you finally knew for sure that you were gay. But looks can be very important within the gay world.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I knew I was gay from a very young age, and the pressure I felt, you know, as a young adult and as a young man to look thin and to look good, I think was exacerbated by the notion that that was a special currency in the gay community.
So it affected you when you were thinking about dating.
Yeah, no, I mean, it ratcheted up the anxiety of everything, absolutely.
And what happened? Were you treated like a fat boy?
Well, you know, I wasn't always fat. I was always going up and down. So, and when I was down, I would date. I mean, when I was down in weight, I would date and I would do okay. But I was always haunted by this notion that fatness was right around the corner.
What happened when you went to visit Scott?
When I went to visit Scott?
Yeah.
From the book. Well, yeah. One of my, even when I wasn't overweight, I was so convinced I was or worried about it that that was a first date of sorts in which I refused to take my windbreaker off the entire time and somehow thought I had convinced him that I was more comfortable that way.
Even
really,
though you were sweating.
Like, right, where I just really thought it would be great if I could just not expose my body.
Your mother didn't give you a hard time about being gay. Didn't she try to fix you up with a waiter at one point?
I had a great mother. And yeah, once she kind of got over the slight, you know, unsettled reaction, like, wow, my son is gay, she immediately proceeded to, how do we make sure he's happy? So once when visiting me in college, she tried to pick the waiter up for me, yeah.
Frank,
she thought he was cute.
Frank Bruni is my guest. His memoir, Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater, is published by the Penguin Press. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with Frank Bruni, who was named restaurant critic for the New York Times in April 2004. Before that, he served as the newspaper's Rome bureau chief and as a White House correspondent. His 2002 book about George Bush, Ambling into History, was a New York Times bestseller and was the last time I saw you before you went into disguise. His most recent book is called Born Round, R-O-U-N-D, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater, published by the Penguin Press. And did you, like other New York Times critics, suddenly feel like you had to go incognito? Were you wearing disguises? Ruth Reichel used to wear wigs and do all sorts of odd things.
I wore disguises on a couple of occasions when I had a restaurateur who was threatening to throw me out if he spotted me. But most of the time I didn't disguise myself, but I made reservations under aliases, fake phone numbers, all of that.
And I'm sure you knew that some people recognized you.
Sure.
You were spotted.
Oh, yeah.
So how did that affect a review?
Well, you know, I mean,
suddenly all this attention is being paid to you. You may have been seated in Siberia because they didn't know when you called to make the reservation who you were, but they knew who you were then, and you were getting the kind of attention I wasn't getting at the next table.
Well, I don't know. You might have been getting great attention, but you know, you factor that in. You as you rate the service in your mind, you realize that you're not getting representative service. You try to look at what's happening elsewhere in the restaurant.
Do you cook?
I haven't had to cook for 5.5 years. I'm just now kind of refocusing on that.
During the time when you were in college, your parents moved from New York to La Jolla.
Yes, lucky me.
And why did they move there?
Dad was transferred from one office to another, to the San Diego office.
It's a whole other food world, isn't it?
It is a whole, yeah. No, suddenly it was, you know, avocados and burritos, and it was great. You know, I mean, I've been lucky. I've traveled a lot in my life, both personally and professionally. And one of the first things I always do is look for the good local restaurants.
Although it's when you say you became well acquainted with Mexican Speed and Metamucil.
Well, this is an example of my disordered relationship with food in the past. While enjoying burritos and avocados, I was also sneaking down to Tijuana to buy over-the-counter Speed so I could help control my weight.
And you were sleep eating? What's sleep? I know what sleepwalking is. What's sleep eating?
It's exactly what it sounds like. You get up when you're not really quite awake and you eat. And this would happen to me because I would eat so little during the day at times in my effort to lose weight that my body would literally yank me awake at night.
After college, you went to Columbia Journalism School, and then you started working at newspapers, the New York Post?
New York Post briefly, then the Detroit Free Press, and then the Times.
And did the eating problems continue no matter where you were?
Yeah, they were always there. I mean, either I was fairly slim but staying that way through extreme measures, or I was overweight by a little bit, and then it all kind of went to – it all went to a new level of bad in my mid-30s when I really plumped up.
This affected your social life. You write, the weekend is only 3 days away, four if you sign up for Saturday as opposed to Friday night, and that's not enough time. In 4 days, you might be able to lose 3 pounds tops, and that's assuming several 5-mile runs.
The number of dates I put off for social engagements that I delayed because I was going to lose a lot of weight in the next 3 days, I can't even count them. And I think anyone who has struggled with a weight problem knows what I'm talking about.
Although there are some men who like fatties, don't they?
I suppose so. But, you know, and I'm glad you said that because there's nothing wrong with being overweight. But for some of us, we're not happy when we're seriously overweight in addition to not being in our healthiest form. And that was the case with me. I needed to trim down to be happy.
But at the same time, food was always something you turned to in moments of stress. And you came to New York to work for the New York Times. I'm sure that was quite stressful.
Well, it's no accident that it was when I was covering national politics and following around George W. Bush that I ballooned up to 275 pounds.
Wow.
Yeah, I was a big boy, yeah.
And then you discovered your mother had cancer.
That happened beforehand, and I think it was the combination of kind of personal hardship and professional stress that kind of sent me into food in a whole new abusive way.
You write that you often found yourself rushing out the door to a nearby bodega for beer, for chips, for ice cream, for all of it, or rifling through a stack of delivery menus. It was a fast, easy, certain source of pleasure, not dependent on the assent or participation of anyone else.
I mean, that's an example of overeating can be a lot like drug use. I mean, it's a way to get a quick fix and a quick pleasure.
And you never consulted a doctor?
I had doctor. I mean, not a mental therapist, not a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I mean, I had doctors who did my physical checkups who said, Frank, you got to lose weight.
Well, you also started taking Prozac.
I did for a brief period of time. I mean, that was. Both mood cause, but also because I had heard that maybe for some people the side effect of that was weight loss. For me, it was not.
What happened when you were about to have your book on President Bush published?
They
put a photograph on the book, and you were very aware of just how heavy you were at the time.
It is a photograph that's still in circulation, and that's completely false. I was so embarrassed by how heavy I was that I sent a photograph into HarperCollins, the publishers, that had been photoshopped so that I had a longer, thinner face.
So I assume that some of the restaurants that had your picture posted had that picture posted. And some guy who looks like you with an elongated face got incredible treatment when he went to some restaurants.
Here's the funny thing, Leonard. Most of the ones that have that said, wow, you're thinner than that, because that was an elongated face from 275-pound heavy, Frank. You know, by the time I was down below 200, that actually looked heavier than the reality.
You were living in D.C. at the time. D.C. Mm-hmm. has some pretty good restaurants, too. Were you eating out a lot?
I was eating out only a little bit because I was mostly on the road eating in campaign planes and in Marriotts and, you know.
And then you went to Rome. Now, Rome is one of the greatest food cities of the world. And pasta has lots of carbohydrates. Risottos have lots of carbohydrates. There's lots of sugar in all those fabulous gelatos and pastries.
There are. Yeah, but Italians don't eat the portions that we do. I mean, I had the good fortune of going to Italy right after I'd lost all the weight and needed to maintain that weight loss. And what I saw in Italy helped me because Western Europeans do not, they don't pig out the way we do. They don't have all-you-can-eat buffets. They don't have 7-Eleven big gulps. That's all American.
Mm-hmm. And they put smaller portions on your plate.
Yeah, they really exalt the quality of food and not the quantity. Here in the land of bigger is better, we're always talking about how much food a restaurant serves. In Italy, they don't measure things that way.
Well, you came by a couple of times to talk about books around this time, but to be honest, I don't remember you looking like this.
You don't remember me looking fatter?
As you do now.
You remember me looking heavier?
Yes.
I was a heavier man, yeah.
Is this the best you've been?
I'm
as a restaurant critic who's eaten out every night for five years?
This is exactly how I've been for the 5.5 years I've done this. I haven't gained a pound doing this, and it's proof that you can really, really enjoy food and not gain weight if you do it the right way.
Well, you can't, like other weight-conscious diners, skip dessert when you're a restaurant reviewer.
No. I mean, I have to eat it all. But what I can do is make sure to exercise, you know, as a compensatory thing, and I can also make sure not to eat every single morsel of food on my plate. A couple bites is enough.
How did your family and your boyfriend at the time respond when you told them you were being offered the job as restaurant reviewer for the New York Times?
They responded quietly because they knew that throughout my life I'd been so self-conscious about my weight that I think they were afraid to say to me, Frank, what's that going to do to your weight? Because they knew that this was a thing I thought about more than anybody else.
And were they concerned what it might do to your health?
No, I think they were, but they were all pretty quiet at the time. And I think all relieved as the years went by during doing this job, and I didn't gain weight.
Well, you obviously wanted the job a lot because you changed your whole lifestyle, didn't you?
Well, my lifestyle had been changed before I said yes to the job, and it's why I knew I could say yes. But taking the job was a little bit of a gamble.
Mm-hmm. And you had changed your lifestyle by finally not being lazy anymore.
Not being lazy anymore, not going on fad diets, not having big pig outs because I said I was going to fast the next day. I ate steadily but sensibly.
But, you know, Weight Watchers and all of those other ways, those sensible ways of eating, really do not involve foie gras. They don't involve all of the incredibly butter-rich things that you've been eating on a regular basis for the last 5 years.
They don't involve those things, but the larger principle of calories in, calories out, and portion control, you can transfer those principles to more luxurious foods.
And then, as you've pointed out in a recent article, you went out with other people to go eating so they could eat the bulk of the really calorie-rich dish. You could have a bite or two.
I mean, that was one thing that they were good for, yeah, was to kind of absorb the excess calories.
Don't waiters become suspicious when they see people putting the plate, you know, rotating the plate around the table?
I think to some degree they do, but we live in such a foodie moment right now that actually average diners are often swapping plates. So it's, I think they're a little bit less suspicious than they might be because of the moment.
My guest is Frank Bruni, who's written a memoir called Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater. Do you think that somebody who has a weight problem reading this book will be encouraged?
I know so because although it's only been out a little while, I've been getting a lot of emails from people who say that they've seen their own behavior in there, and they've also seen some glimmers of a path out.
Mm-hmm. Your last food column for The Times was published just a couple of weeks ago, and in it you laid out all the wisdom that you gleaned. Have you learned a lot?
Oh, yeah.
Well, also been in New York at a time of transition, haven't you? First of all, there's been the recent economic downturn, but we've seen New York become very much, as Eric Ripert pointed out earlier, very much a fusion cuisine city.
A fusion cuisine city, but you know, the even bigger transition I think during these last years has been the turn away from fine dining. You know, Eric is an exemplar of a certain kind of fine dining that, because he does it at such a high level at Le Bernardin, will never go out of style there. But those restaurants are becoming fewer and farther between.
Well, one of the restaurants in that class told me that that they're still filling up the room every night, but they may not have a third sitting on some tables, and the banquets have pretty much died because even the companies that are doing well are afraid to spend a lot of money on a fancy meal for their employees or for their clients because they're afraid it's going to get onto page six.
Yeah, no, it's sort of like an economically incorrect version of politically incorrect. Yeah, no, and that's why you've seen a couple restaurants in Manhattan take their private banquet rooms and turn them into casual, cheaper wings of the restaurant. I mean, that's a really good metaphor for what's happened.
Well, I remember the last time we had an economic downturn and a whole bunch of very fancy, low-price restaurants opened like JoJo. Then as the economy improved, JoJo became just as expensive as Jean-Georges' previous restaurant had been.
Well, it's what we all learned in Economics 101, that you charge what the market will bear, and as the market begins to improve and bear more, the prices go up, you know.
The The big problem in New York is finding that great place that nobody else knows about that's really good.
Right.
Is there such a place?
I think in the age of the internet, that place has gone away. Because if the New York Times restaurant critic hasn't discovered it, or the New York Magazine restaurant critic hasn't discovered it, there is some blogger who has, and things go viral pretty fast.
And then people start asking you, how come you haven't been to such and such restaurant?
And then you get there fast.
Is it still mostly Manhattan?
I did quite a number of reviews in Brooklyn, and I think one of the happiest developments over the years I've been critic has been the expansion of the Brooklyn dining scene. I dine frequently in Brooklyn now since I've left the job, and I love dining in Brooklyn.
Two or three of my favorite restaurants are in Brooklyn.
Which ones?
Well, I love Al Di La. Just your standard Italian meal done perfectly.
Absolutely.
And I've liked places, some of the places on Smith Street,
mm-hmm.
Which are pretend to something more, but the prices are lower.
The prices tend to be lower in Brooklyn, yeah. I mean, not dramatically, but 15-10%. I mean, enough that you feel a little bit more at ease about what you're spending.
Another place I like is the Good Fork, although it's a – have you been there?
That's in Red Hook.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have been there.
It's a big schlep.
Yeah, it is. You probably, I don't know if you've been to Dressler. That's another great place in Brooklyn that opened during my tenure. There's a lovely, lovely, sweet place called Vinegar Hill House. I don't know if you've been there.
I have not, but now I'm going to go. And there are many people who swear by the new Chinatowns, the Chinatown in Queens and the Chinatown in Brooklyn.
The Chinatown in Queens particularly, there's some great food out there in Flushing at the end of the 7 Line.
I live in a neighborhood where a new sushi restaurant just opened, and I'm afraid to go in there because nobody's in there. Doesn't matter. If nobody's there, my sense is that the fish is going to get old, and they're going to have to throw it out, or they're going to give me fish that isn't as fresh as it has to be for sushi. This is a problem during economic downturn, isn't it?
Well, I've been wondering, and it would be an impossible story to write because no one would be honest, but I have been wondering that same question. Like, is the freshness of food suffering as it sits around longer, be it fish or something else, because there aren't as many customers in the seats? It's a good question.
What will you miss about being a restaurant critic? Because every restaurant critic I've ever spoken to has talked about the job as though it was oppressive.
The scheduling and certain aspects of the fact that you can't be socially spontaneous, that becomes a little bit oppressive is a big word, but it becomes grueling.
Well, every night sometimes you're even having a lunch.
I've had two dinners in one night in order to kind of canvas more restaurants. But what I'll miss, and this is a corny answer, but when someone's doing great work out there and when you trip across a great meal where you didn't expect one and you have this megaphone that you can lift and shout to the world, there's real merit over here and you can improve that person's life, you can steer readers to a great find, that's a great feeling.
The last time you were here in person, you were not in disguise. Are you happy to be able to come out of the cold again?
I used to step away from cameras and step to the edges of photos over the last 5 years whenever one was lifted, even at a family gathering, just by impulse. It's nice not to feel that guarded anymore, yeah.
And where do you go from here? Because Ruth Reichel went on to edit a major magazine. William Grimes, as I said, he was reviewing books for a while. Now he's writing obituaries. Can you go back to hard news? Would you want to?
Well, I'm going to be writing full-time for the Sunday magazine. And although we wouldn't call that hard news just because they're longer magazine pieces, I'll be doing politics, international affairs, all of it. I'm basically going to get to kind of fall back into all the things I've done, but in a constant rotation.
And this is your first book in a while. The past ones were about politics. Did it feel good writing a book again?
This one felt good to write because it's a much more literary book. It's a much more story-driven book than the other ones I've done. The other ones were topical, and this is straight from the heart. This is a very heartfelt narrative, and it's special to me.
And now you can actually go to restaurants and say, hi, my name is Frank Bruni.
And I hope they'll just treat me like any. I hope it doesn't cause pangs of fear or anything like that.
Well, I suspect some people will be thrilled to see you, and others will say, what was wrong with that risotto? It wasn't overcooked.
I think I'm going to steer myself towards the places that smile at me.
You'll be speaking and signing books this on Tuesday the 22nd at 7:30 at the Lincoln Center Barnes & Noble store. It's Broadway and 66th Street. and also speaking and signing books on Thursday, September 24th at 7 at the Bordas Books and Music at 461 Park Avenue. That's at 57th Street. And you won't have to be disguising yourself or anything, and get finally to meet everyone, which has to be a lot of fun, although you've been blogging, haven't you?
Yeah, no, I feel like I already have a good connection with readers through the internet, and that's lovely.
Thank you so much for being with us. Frank Bruni, the book Born Round, The Secret History of a Full-Time Eater, published by the Penguin Press. You've probably heard that omega-3s are good for you, but on tomorrow's show we'll unravel why they've all but disappeared from Western diets and the possible health consequences that could have for each of us. Then actor and political playwright Wallace Shawn also will learn about the life of Clarice Lispector, one of the most popular but least understood of the Latin American writers, plus Harvard primatologist Richard Wrangham on the key role cooking played in human evolution. The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Stephen Valentino, and Julia Corcoran. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. We had help today from Adam Delahanty and Drew Katchen. Debbie Fountain was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.